Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Jebediah are an Australian alternative rock band formed in 1994 in Perth, Western Australia. They were formed by Chris Damond on lead guitar, Kevin Mitchell on lead vocals and rhythm guitar, and Vanessa Thornton on bass guitar. They were joined a year later by Kevin's older brother, Brett Mitchell, on drums. After winning the National Campus Band Competition, the group were brought to national attention when their 1996 single Jerks of Attention received heavy airplay on Australian alternative radio station Triple J, which was followed by their breakthrough debut album Slight Odd Way in 1997. The band released four studio albums by 2004. Three entered the top 10 on their ARIA albums chart. Their second album, Of Someday Shambles, is the highest charting at number 2. After touring to celebrate their 10th anniversary, the band went on hiatus in 2005. Kevin Mitchell continued solo work under his pseudonym Bob Evans. Jebediah reconvened in 2010 and released their fifth studio album in the following year, which charted in the ARIA Top 10. Their sixth studio album was released this year in 2024. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Kevin Mitchell from Jebediah. Where do we find you in the world and how are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm in a place called Ocean Grove, which is in the state of Victoria in Australia, on the east coast. So just near Melbourne, basically on the western tip of the bay that Melbourne is kind of in the middle of.
Why the name Jebediah? Where does that come from?
Well, Jebediah, I think it was suggested as a band name by our guitar player, Chris, in 1995 was when we first started. And the way we remember it is that we were having a conversation. We were 17 years old at this point in time, but for some reason we were having a conversation about what names we were going to give our children if we ever had children. And Chris suggested the name Jebediah for his kid. And we took that and used it as the band name. And I think it comes from we were massive fans of The Simpsons TV show. Yeah. Jebediah Springfield is the name of the founder of Springfield. So I think that's where Jebediah came from originally.
I love that story. It's super cool. So we know that you guys formed in around 1995. So now focusing specifically on you, at what age, whether as a child or a teenager, did you feel cool? You want to be in the music world. How did that story progress? And then how did you meet the rest of the band and the journey of the band's story up until present? I know it's multiple decades. So the hybrid version of the Jebediah story.
Yeah, well, I guess my interest in music sort of came in waves. I mean, it started when I was like about sort of 5 or 6 and I was in love with this TV show called Fame.
Yes.
All these kids in, you remember that? Because New York kids, you know, dancers and singers and musicians. And I was just loved that show. I just saw that as a vision of that life, I couldn't believe that a life like that was even possible. And that's what got me into music. And then I started writing songs in my sort of imagination when I was about 12. And that's when I decided to start learning to play an instrument, picked up the guitar just as a way to really, to try and turn these ideas that I could hear songs in my head. I needed a way to kind of get them out. Yeah, just learned the basics on guitar when I was 12, 13, which was also the same year that I met Chris, the guitar player in Jebediah. We went to school together. And then Vanessa, the bass player, was 2 years older than us at school, but in the same grade as my brother and Chris's sister. So they were all friends. We became friends. And then Brett is the drummer, and he's my brother, so I've known him my whole life. We all went through high school together, but we didn't form the band till the year that I finished, till the year after we finished high school. We started university, formed the band right at the start of the year in February, and played our first show by May of that year, 1995, and just went from there.
When you guys started being successful, Was it not necessarily a surprise because you had been working hard at it, but was it a trajectory that you put with an intention into achieving, or was it more of like, well, let's just do this and see how it goes and, you know, go with the flow?
We, when we started the band, our kind of, what we really dreamt was that we'd be able to play a gig at, like, you know, one of our favorite venues in Perth, Western Australia, that's where we grew up. Supporting one of our favorite Australian bands like UMI or Magic Dirt or Tumbleweed, because it, for the 2 years before we started the band, you know, we used to go to all ages shows in Perth as much as we could. You know, whenever a band, a big Australian band was touring, we would go. And it was quite a fertile scene at that time. You know, Triple J was, had become the national broadcaster in Australia and was broadcasting sort of alternative music all around the country. And this brand new, this huge audience was starting to gather, and all these new bands were starting to kind of become popular. And we were really into that scene as kids. And so when we formed the band, we just wanted to kind of go from being in the crowd to being up on stage. You know, we wanted to do what we'd been watching all these bands do. So that was really the ultimate ambition. And maybe, you know, we used to go to the Big Day Out Festival as well. We thought, oh, if we could ever play at the Big Day Out one day, that would just be the ultimate. So, you know, our ambitions were fairly modest, and so the trajectory of the band was quite quick. You know, the we got signed to a major label within about a year of forming, and you know, our first record came out in '97, so 2 years after we formed, and was a, you know, a really popular record here in Australia. From there, it was just, it was a career all of a sudden, and we were playing the main stage on the Big Day Out, and we were sort of doing all those things that we kind of wanted to do, but it happened fast. And so for a few years there, we were sort of felt like we'd kind of been thrust into this world that we, that was kind of beyond our expectations. We were still very young, you know, when I was still a teenager when our first record came out. Yeah, things got quite big and serious very quickly. And so part of, a lot of it just kind of felt like we were just hanging on for dear life for those first few years.
You mentioned that you guys have been creating music since 95, 96, 97, with your first album coming out in 97. So what keeps you guys getting into the studio to create new music and keep getting up on stage and performing live?
We've kind of survived through all the inevitable kind of ups and downs. You know, by the time after our third album came out, we were dropped by Sony, who was our label, and we became an independent band from that point on. And then I started doing solo stuff, and we took a kind of went on hiatus for a couple of years. And then we came back and made another record and have been going strong ever since. And, you know, I think it's because the four of us, you know, we've all known each other since we were kids. You know, we've kind of been a little gang of friends since we were 12 years old. We all grew up in the same suburb. We all went to school together. And It's kind of like family as much as friends, or it's like a marriage maybe, but it's sort of, the friendship is just so deep now, and it's been going for so long that we kind of managed to kind of get through all the kind of rough stuff, that sort of mid-career rough patch that everybody goes through, come out the other end, and you know, we still love what we do. We still love spending time together, and we love making music together and playing live. That love has never gone away. I think if we didn't like each other or if didn't get on so well, it probably would have lost that love a long time ago. But it's still there. And so now we kind of, we're in this really kind of great position now where we can kind of do what we want, do whatever we want to do. And we don't have to answer to anybody. And we're kind of doing it for the same reasons that we did at the start, you know, we're doing it because we love it. We love hanging out, making a noise. So, yeah, I feel kind of lucky that we've sort of managed to kind of hang in there long enough to kind of see this, to get through to this moment, because this moment's really great.
You referenced this, so I hope it's okay that I ask, and I've heard this from a lot of artists. So I understand that you have your experience, but a general question, what would the reasons be that a record label would drop an artist from their roster?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's a bunch of reasons. For, you know, I can only speak for us. Yeah. For ourselves. So when we were signed to Sony back in 1996, there was a real kind of, there was a real scene, a big, you know, Silverchair were kind of like the big, biggest sort of band in Australia at that time, a new band anyway. And, you know, that alternative music thing was just still really peaking post kind of grunge and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of bands were selling a lot of records. And so major labels were signing young bands like Silverchair that, you know, and we sort of were part of that wave. And our first two records were very successful, and they would have made a good amount of money from it. But then by the time my third record came out, it was 2002, and the music scene was changing. You know, that wave of alternative thing was starting to die out. Pop music was starting to really come back in a big way. And our third album also, you know, sold a fraction of what the first two did. So from the label's point of view, they're looking at this band that maybe they signed in the first place kind of as much as an opportunistic thing as anything, you know, because they wanted to kind of sign bands that were part of this movement that was happening. Well, that movement finished and the records weren't selling them so much anymore. So it's like, well, there wasn't really any point in them keeping us on. And we'd kind of got to the stage too where we were sort of like actively kind of trying to figure out, well, how do we go about getting ourselves out of this contract, you know, because it wasn't really serving either of us. You know, we were probably never really a major label kind of band, you know. I don't think we were ever destined to kind of become a slick kind of polished rock and roll band, you know. What we were at the start, that's who we were. It's who we were always going to be. Yeah. We weren't going to get turned into some, you know, slick band. So, you know, some bands do that. Some bands kind of evolve and progress and they, you know, and their sound becomes more mainstream or whatever. Ours was never going to, never did. So it kind of made sense, you know. We weren't upset about it when it happened, you know. We were kind of like, we kind of saw it as, you know, an opportunity to kind of figure out who we were in a way.
So you guys have been independent since that period, which was the beginning of the 2000s. And you guys, I guess, were sort of the trailblazers, or one of the trailblazers in doing it, because there weren't many artists at that stage who were independent. Many were mainly on labels. So for the listeners who are unsure or do not know, what's the difference between being signed to a label and being an independent artist?
Well, once again, there's many, many ways to do it. So I'll just speak about our situation. So, Yes. You know, for us, we basically self-finance our records and then we license them to labels. So the first record, after when we first became independent, we had our own label going at that time that had distribution through an independent distribution company. So that record came out on our own label through this independent distribution company. And then when we came back, we took a bit of a break. We came back in 2011. We made another record. We went to the studio, basically financed it all ourselves and everything. Finished the record. It was mixed. It was everything. We had this finished record that we handed over to a small boutique label called Due Process in Australia. They had distribution through a major label. So that's how that record came out. And then with this one, different again, similar to the last record in that we had a finished product. Found a label called Cooking Vinyl here in Australia. Well, Cooking Vinyl is an English label that's got a branch here in Australia. And so we licensed it to them. And I think, funnily enough, their distro might be through Sony, which has kind of come full circle in a way. But so for us, it's kind of like we have the total creative control, and we finish the record ourselves without anybody sort of being a part of it. Then we kind of go around to independent labels, see if anybody's interested in putting it out. Okay. Someone puts their hand out. But yeah, for us, we like doing it through a label rather than completely ourselves, because that whole business side of things isn't something that we want to completely control. Once the creative bit's over, then we're ready to kind of hand the reins over to somebody who knows how to do the business side of things, because that's not really us. It's not really our strength. Okay. But, you know, for some bands, you know, they're independent, 100% independent, you know, in a way that we're not, in that, they literally will do everything themselves. They put stuff out on their own label. Their distribution is all independent, everything. And I think, so we've been doing this independent thing for 20 years now almost. And, you know, it's so different now, obviously, than 20 years ago. You know, now that streaming and digital music is kind of like the main thing. Yeah, all the kind of mechanisms of how music is bought and sold have completely changed now from 20 years ago. So in some respects, things have gotten easier to do things independently. In other ways, it's gotten harder because it's harder to make a living and stuff out of it as well. So that's my overview.
I love me a CD. For me, it's an energy exchange to you guys for all the hard work that you do. I love the experience of what I'm going to buy, the receiving, the unpacking, the listening, the booklet. Listening, as I said, from song one to whatever number. I'm not sure if you're aware that physical formats, CDs, even cassettes and vinyls are climbing again. Last year, vinyls had the biggest sales in the UK since 1990. So all of these elements are happening and growing. And again, it's the younger kids, the teenagers and the early 20s who are diving into this world. We've also got these digital platforms or these streaming platforms where people consume music on. What are your observations and perceptions of where the landscape or the musical landscape is at the moment?
Yeah, well, absolutely aware of the vinyl, what's happening in vinyl. You know, that's been really great, you know, because there was a period of time during our band's life where our records didn't even get pressed on vinyl. Our early ones did, and then for those couple of years in the very early 2000s, we didn't have our records pressed on vinyl, and then the vinyl thing started to get big again in the later 2000s, and now, you know, you wouldn't even dream of doing a release without a vinyl. I wasn't aware that CD sales were going up. That's news to me. And, you know, I guess, you know, there's a quality to CDs that you get that you don't have with digital music. And so it's possible, I suppose, that, you know, younger audiences that didn't necessarily grow up with CDs are discovering maybe a superior sound quality that they haven't been used to and maybe are getting into that. I don't know, maybe there's a kind of retro appeal to a physical product, you know, again, that they haven't grown up with and that they're finding something cool about that. You know, streaming is still, you know, the dominant kind of force. And in the past, you know, we used to talk about, you know, getting songs away on radio and all that kind of stuff. Now it's like getting onto playlists on Spotify and things like that. So I suppose, you know, to describe the landscape, the way it's changed, it's like obviously the way that people are discovering music and accessing music is really, really different. I don't think radio necessarily holds the kind of power that perhaps it did, you know, a decade or so ago. Streaming, as much as streaming is problematic because of artists just don't make anywhere near the money that they should from it, from a consumer's point of view, I can see the appeal and the magic of it, you know, to have the almost like the entire history of popular music at your fingertips. And it doesn't even need to cost you a cent if you're willing to sit through a few ads.
Yeah.
And the discovery, you know, the rabbit holes you can go down on something like Spotify, just discovering everything's just another click away. And before you know it, you're listening to some obscure band from some town in America that you've never heard of, when you just started off, you know, putting on Nirvana, and before you know it, you're in some place you've never heard of, or some tiny band that's got like 5,000 followers, whatever, because, you know, of those algorithms and stuff. So, you know, I can see the appeal of that from a, it's like the modern version of crate digging, you know, but yeah, obviously in the time that I've been in a musician, in the last 30 years, you know, that landscape has changed enormously, and it will keep changing as well.
Okay, so tell us all about the latest album and project.
Yeah, we made this record called Oiks, and it's been a really unusual, you know, it's been such a different process to any other record we've made. We started making the record in 2018 when we first went into the studio, and we had no songs. We just went into the studio and it was kind of an experiment, really. We thought, well, what we'll do is we'll book a week in the studio. We'll set up, you know, all our stuff, mic everything up in the live room, and we'll go in at night and we'll we'll just jam for like 4 or 5 hours and we'll record everything, record the whole thing. And then the next day we'll come in at midday and we'll spend the afternoon just listening back to everything and just sort of keeping the good stuff and deleting the bad stuff, cutting, pasting, seeing what ideas are there, what work, maybe an idea from one jam could work with an idea from a different one, stick them together, make songs. So basically making songs in a quite a very different way to how we've traditionally done them. And that's how we got started. And it worked really, really well. You know, in that first session we wrote, you know, we had ideas for, God, probably about 20 songs. And then it was just a case of going back into the studio every few months and just working up stuff up. And then, of course, we hit 2020. Western Australia closed its borders to the rest of Australia. You couldn't get in because of COVID. And so Brett and I, who live in Victoria on the other side of Australia, for 2 years we couldn't get in. So I put the whole thing sort of on hold. And then eventually when we were able to get back in, we were able to sort of slowly finish the record and pick it up where we left off, which was quite difficult, you know, after taking such a long break from it. But fortunately, the bulk of the work had been done. The real sort of creative spark had already sort of been lit. And so we were able to just kind of finish it off by about 2022 or so. So, and now here we are in 2024 and it's finally coming out. So it's just been a very long process, what I would definitely describe as a labor of love, because there was a while there where I wasn't sure that we would finish it at all. But yeah, once again, I think we just sort of, you know, relied on that sort of, the strength of our relationships with one another really kind of pulled the whole project together in the end.
I'm so looking forward to hearing the new music and album. You guys have headlined and performed at your own shows, you've opened for other artists, and you have performed at festivals. Naturally, you put the same amount of energy into the output of those shows. But for you, what is the difference between headlining your own shows, performing at festivals, and opening for other artists?
When you're playing at a festival, you know that you're outdoors and the crowd is often so big that, and they're kind of far away. And so you don't have that sort of intimacy, you know, you're not sort of not exactly looking people eye to eye. And so it's a different kind of thing, you know, it's like, you know, Greek theatre, you know, where they used to go on stage with like the massive big headmasks and stuff so that people right at the back could see. You're performing for the people right at the back in a sense. You know, when you're playing in a pub or a club, you can touch people literally if you wanted to, you know, everybody's sharing each other's sweat and body odor, which of course, you know, we couldn't do for a few years. And so, yeah, there's just that intimacy, I suppose. And, you know, both of those things are fun. I mean, it's great fun playing on a big stage to tens of thousands of people when you get the chance, you know, at a festival. We don't get to do that on our own. But yeah, playing in a club to a few hundred people that are all there for you is far more intimate and really, really special. So the other thing too is the difference is the backstage, you know, like backstage at a festival, it's kind of like a party if it's good. And so some of my favorite memories of playing at festivals like Big Day Out, but a lot of those festivals, I can't even really remember the gig, you know, it goes by, it's such a blur.
Yes.
You know, there's so much adrenaline and you're playing to this sea of people and you're just, all of a sudden it's over and it's like, what happened? Most of my favorite memories of playing at festivals is what happens after the gig and the hours spent hanging around backstage with other bands and forming friendships with people. And the community vibe of a festival is, I guess, what makes those really special.
And I've also heard that there's good catering at the festivals.
Well, there can be, yeah. I mean, there are definitely festivals that go all out with the catering, and it's fantastic. You know, when you're playing your own show, you know, dinner is like a platter of chips and nuts. That's not a, you know, not living large. So yeah, I mean, that's always nice. But you know, sometimes it's wait. You know, the catering's kind of wait. There's so many festivals that I've played where I just haven't wanted to eat. You know, I had all that this great opportunity to eat, and you know, dinner. Maybe you're on stage right at dinner time or something, or you don't want to eat before you play because you'd be all full. But then after you finish playing, you've got so much adrenaline that you can't sit down and eat. So sometimes it's been a bit wasted on us.
I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 years, I know your answer will be different every time because there are millions of them. I recognize that and I understand that. I'm not saying favorite, I'm saying top of mind. But if you had to push play to five songs by other artists once we finish this conversation, what would those five songs be and by whom?
Well, the first one would be a song called Sappy by Nirvana. Big Nirvana, you know, Nirvana were a big reason why I started. But Jeb and I started, really. And there's a song called Sappy, which it doesn't appear on any of their records, so it's kind of a bit of a, what do they call that, a deep cut. Or it's a deeper cut because it's not on an album. But it's kind of a rarity, I guess. And but it's one of their best songs, one of my favourite Nirvana songs ever. I think it was recorded in the sort of era between Nevermind and In Utero, or maybe it's got more in common with a Nevermind song, but... It's just a lost, it's kind of like a lost treasure. Although, you know, when I first heard that song, it was on this CD called No Alternative, and which was really hard to find. You know, now in this day and age of streaming, you know, all these rarities, they're not rare, you know, they're so much easier to find now, you know. It used to be impossible to find. So, yeah, Nirvana, Sappy, what else? I think Wilco have put out some new music recently. Which I haven't listened to properly. So maybe I'd go check out the latest Wilco record. I think it's called Cousin. It might have come out at the end of last year. I'm a big Wilco fan, but I haven't listened to it properly. Been digging a lot of 80s stuff, like a lot of sort of jangly British stuff like The Smiths and The Cure. So I'd probably go, there's a Smith song called William, It Was Really Nothing. I love, and I'm a sucker for The Cure, like maybe Friday I'm in Love, why not? And one more, what would I go for? Let's see, I would crack into a little bit of alt country, maybe the Panisse Brothers. So yeah, Overcome by Happiness by Joe Panisse would be the other one.
So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So as a final message, what would you like to say?
If you can find it in your heart to, and your time of day to listen to the new Jebediah record, Oix, be very much appreciated, especially if you live outside of Australia, because I'd really love to get an audience outside of Australia so I can go on some overseas trips, do some overseas touring. I've actually been to South Africa a couple of times by my solo. Yeah, I did some tours. My solo pseudonym is called Bob Evans. I came to South Africa and toured with a guy named Farrell Perkis, who's an old mate. Yeah, so I've got fond memories of being over there and traveling around the coast, going to like playing on this massive stage to very few people. I was the first on at this big festival. It was like a surf. It was like a big surf contest down at the beach. I was playing on this massive stage by myself and there was like, you know, about 10 people out on the beach. But I didn't care though because I was in another country and, you know, whenever I'm traveling in another country, I'm just having the best time. So, yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.